Before a certain virus came along, antibiotic-resistant bacteria is what kept many global health officials up at night. Just when we come up with life-saving drugs to fight infection, microbes evolve to defend themselves. It's what they do. And Mohammed Zaman is a professor of biomedical engineering and international health at Boston University. He explains why microbes are becoming superbugs, how our decisions help them get stronger, and why there is nonetheless cause for optimism. It's all in his new book, Biography of Resistance, The Epic Battle Between People and Pathogens. And Mohammed Zaman joins me now. Hello there.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you. And bacteria have been around for billions of years. What makes them such survival machines?
Well, so, so bacteria have been around the planet for about 3.5 billion years, and that's a conservative estimate. And there's a sort of a battle, sort of an arms race going on between the bacteria who produce antibiotics, and they have been producing it from the very beginning, and other bacteria that have come up with sort of novel defense mechanisms. And that's why there is no one kind of bacteria, and you have such huge diversity, because there's sort of this equilibrium and balance that has been going on. They are tiny little creatures, but sort of with these sophisticated machines of producing these novel drugs, many of them have become potent drugs for us to ward off infection, as well as mechanisms to ward them off. And this sort of evolutionary battle and growth has been going on for quite some time. What has changed in the last 90 or so years since the development of antibiotics for clinical purposes is the disruption of that balance through sort of, I would say, hubris and greed and a set of bad decisions, along with sort of global challenges in conflict that have sort of really allowed one kind of bacteria or certain groups of bacteria to thrive more than the other.
How do antibiotics work?
So antibiotics are molecules that would go and attack the bacteria in a number of ways. So think of the bacteria as some kind of a medieval castle, so to speak, with sort of a fortified wall and this outside defense mechanism and an internal mechanism, which is sort of the nerve center. So the antibiotics would do several things. They could go and sort of poke holes in this outside wall and then hence make the bacteria vulnerable to basically dying and not surviving. They could also attack the nerve center, the DNA of the bacteria, its replication machinery as well, that would ensure that the bacteria do not divide, or they could cause other kinds of damages in its metabolism so that the bacteria are unable to survive. So either it would completely kill it, or it would stop it from replicating. And there are different kinds of mechanisms out there that do that. Different antibiotics work differently, but there are sort of broad classes that would sort of do one of these things.
We can't say, by the way, that we weren't warned about bacterial resistance. Apparently, there was even a warning from the man who discovered penicillin.
That's right. That's right. And it's both ironic and somewhat tragic that in his Nobel Prize speech right after the Second World War, where penicillin was your sort of miracle drug, so to speak, that really sort of helped the powers defeat the Nazis and their allies. This man who has done such a remarkable job for humanity stands up in Stockholm and says that, look, if we do not use it prudently, if we overuse it, then we will have a problem at our hand. And I think at that time, I think it probably fell on deaf ears. At that time, people did not fully appreciate it, but now these words couldn't be truer.
When did that theory then, the theory of antibiotic resistance, become a reality? When did they first come across a patient who couldn't be helped?
Well, so actually it even came before Alexander Fleming. So in the 1930s, the big deal were the sulfa drug, the sulfanamide drugs, and they were used extensively in the war, in the Second World War, but they were actually not working very well, to the point that Brigadier General Elliot Cutler, who was head of one of the sort of U.S. Missions in Europe, in Western Europe, during the war, said that in his patients, they were just not working. And they were largely given because of their placebo and their sort of psychological effect, making people feel good that they're getting something, but they were actually not working. His letters are quite remarkable in that regard. But the real change started to happen in late 1940s and early 1950s in the United Kingdom, in a number of wards in Australia, where some of these other drugs were seen to be not potent. Penicillin was one of them. Another drug, methicillin, was seen to be resistant, including sort of the development of what is one of the most feared forms of resistance called MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus, which was seen in the UK and in Australia, and then eventually in the US and all over the world as well. I think the honeymoon period is what is important to recognize. In the late 1940s and 1950s, new drugs were coming to the market very, very regularly. What that meant was some kind of feeling that these drugs are, I mean, that science will always continue to discover those. So what if, what's the big deal if one of them doesn't work? There will be another around the corner. And I think that's where the problem really started to become one that became intractable, that there was a point when the honeymoon period became sort of over in late 1960s, I would say. Certainly by 1970s, it was well known. But the practices continued. At the same time, starting the end of the Second World War, people started using these in animal farms. And while New Zealand has done very, very well, many other countries, including the United States, have not sort of enacted the policies that are needed. And I think that continues to be a problem, despite evidence coming from the 1960s that these are quite problematic.
I mentioned before that this is one of the big concerns before COVID-19, but I've got to ask, is there an even greater fear right now with the, I guess, the possibility of secondary bacterial lung infections in COVID-19 patients?
Absolutely. There is reason to be concerned and let's look back to history for a second. One of the sort of physicians who has become a trusted voice in the United States, Dr. Anthony Fauci, his own work in 2008 actually showed that the great influenza, the pandemic of 1918, most people died not because of a viral infection, even though it's called influenza, but it was sort of the secondary bacterial infection that delivered the knockout punch. So that continues to be a problem. Now, again, one has to recognize that we did not have antibiotics, but we have another problem now of resistance. So that's the first problem. There is some evidence coming in from hospitals that patients who do have coronavirus are in need of antibiotics. And that itself is not surprising. What is more concerning is that if those patients do not respond to antibiotics because of antimicrobial resistance. That's one concern. The second concern is overuse of antibiotics in these patients and developing resistance, not just for them, but also for other patients in the hospital and all of us. There is some evidence from the SARS outbreak of early 2000s that extensive use of antibiotics actually created a problem. And the third problem, which I think is important to recognize, which I certainly appreciate deeply, I grew up in Pakistan myself, in low and middle income countries where the antibiotics are available quite freely without any prescription, there's a very, very acute danger of self-prescription and increased use of antibiotics when they're not needed and using the wrong kind of antibiotics. People do this all the time, unfortunately, in Pakistan and many other countries. So I think there is a danger of this secondary infection and one that can last much longer and certainly can be a problem for a much longer period.
I am talking to Mohammed Zaman, Professor of Biomedical Engineering and International Health at Boston University. He has a book called Biography of Resistance, The Epic Battle Between People and Pathogens. Do you see a time where drug-resistant infections may be as big an issue for the world as this pandemic?
I think we're very close to that point, and I'm concerned about that quite a bit. The conservative estimates, very, very conservative estimates, put the number of people dying because of drug-resistant infections in the United States to be about 32,000 people per year, every year. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Internationally, this number is in several hundred thousand, and that's quite concerning. I think the other thing that we are going to see, if this is not stopped, is how it impacts the practice of medicine. So basic routine operations, whether it is elective surgery or it is C-section, which are certainly not life-threatening in most cases, can become very, very complicated. And at the same time, the problem is that you have people who actually need antibiotics, who actually can get better because of antibiotics. But if they continue to become resistant, then those people who are in need of antibiotics to save their lives, particularly in low and middle income countries, would be in a much worse state. So I think we are very close to a point where this slowly and gradually rising tide can become overwhelming in a very short period of time. There have been reports, and there's some controversy about exact predictions and things like that, but certainly reports commissioned by the UK government and elsewhere that put the number of people dying in millions. And I think while one can debate about the numbers, nobody debates about the impact of this on global economy and certainly lives and morbidities.
Not all bacteria are bad bacteria. We're learning more and more, for example, about the importance of our microbiome. Could there be a way to get the good bacteria in our bodies to fight the bad ones, assist that bacteria to fight the bad ones?
Well, Jesse, I'm really glad that you asked that question, because not until long ago, it was sort of an all-out fight against bacteria. But now we've realized, and rightfully so, that the human microbiome, bacteria in our guts, are actually central to our health, to our immunity, to our growth and development, to our survival. And I think this is important to recognize, that our emphasis should not be sort of wipe out bacteria, but really promote the good bacteria and give them the ability to do what they do best. I'm sure I was in New Zealand last summer, and I'm sure if you were to go to your grocery store, as I did in New Zealand, both in Auckland and in Christchurch, there were plenty of yogurt brands that would say probiotic. I'm not sure if that was the case 20, 30, 40 years ago. So there is, I think, an increasing appreciation for the fact that we need to maintain this balance between good bacteria and bad bacteria. And antibiotics not only sort of harm, excessive use of antibiotics not only harm sort of just overall health and well-being, they also attack the good bacteria, and hence changing that balance as well. So I think a much more nuanced understanding is needed, as opposed to one that is sort of based on one size fits all.
Hey, we love a New Zealand connection, by the way. Thank you. And there's another one too, a doctor called Jeremy Farrer, who pops up in your research.
That's right. He's a remarkable character. Sir Jeremy Farrar is the head of Wellcome Trust, and somebody who was sort of really pushed on to very innovative approaches to looking at antimicrobial resistance. One of them is through his support through the foundation, through the Wellcome Trust, his support of programs like CARB-X that are really incentivizing companies, small and large, to come up with antibiotics, because large companies are leaving it in droves because, well, the reality is, Jesse, there isn't a lot of money to be made compared to cancer or cardiovascular ailments or neurological disorders. So companies are leaving in droves. So Sir Jeremy Farrar, along with sort of a U.S. agency called BARDA and a few other institutions, are funding these groups which are going to incentivize companies to make the drug. So that's one connection. The other connection is sort of Wellcome's approach, which is multi-pronged in terms of awareness and sort of financing and supporting small and large institutions to create awareness in all parts of the world, in languages and in Hindi and Arabic and Mandarin and Japanese and Korean and other languages, where ordinary people can get a sense of why using antibiotics without an appropriate prescription is a terrible idea. It doesn't do anything with seasonal flu. It's a terrible idea to take an antibiotic every time you sneeze. And why is it not just a bad idea for your own health, but the health of people right around you? So they're supporting all kinds of these things, which are part of the solution. And of course, Wellcome Trust is a remarkable resource, and I benefited tremendously in terms of their library and their collections during the writing of the book. So Jeremy Farrar is somebody I look up to tremendously.
You mentioned animals earlier. We've known since the 1960s that the use of antibiotics in agriculture has a human impact. What's going wrong here? Is the political will lagging behind the science when it comes to instituting, you know, meaningful rules about animal antibiotics?
So that's a great question, Jesse. So actually, it started right after the Second World War in late 1940s, and started to pick in the 50s. And certainly became an issue to the point that in the UK there were several commissions instituted to address this issue. Unfortunately, it really came back despite an initial moratorium. I think there are several issues here to consider. The first one that I think one has to know is strong lobbying from the agricultural sector. And I would call hubris and driven by profits. I think that is certainly a concern that has been there. The laws, the way they're written, are also, certainly I'm talking about the United States here, are full of loopholes. So while they may ban the use of antibiotics as prophylaxis, basically saying that you can give a drug to a chicken or a pig or a cow, sort of without any reason. But there are other loopholes such as infection control and things like that that are not really written in a way that really stop the appropriate use of antibiotics, inappropriate use of antibiotics in the farming sector. And then there are other parts of the world, China, India, Pakistan, elsewhere, where sort of the policies have not been as rigorous and as clear. And we've seen, unfortunately, the rise of various kinds of antibiotic-resistant genes that have become a problem. So MCR1 in coming from China, and again, similar challenges in Pakistan and elsewhere that have been there. There are some positive examples. Norway has done very well with the salmon fish industry and have used vaccines as opposed to using widespread antibiotics and sort of these cement mixers. There was a time when they were using them and just dumping them in water. But that has sort of changed, partly because of good science, partly because of public pressure and a recognition that this is really harming all of us. So there are examples, but I think we are nowhere close to where we ought to be. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be any antibiotics whatsoever. I think if there is an infection that needs to be treated, antibiotics should be used. But you have to sort of close the loopholes so that hubris and greed and sort of poor practices and lobbying by the agriculture sector is not driving it, but rather public health that should be the fundamental factor driving policy.
This might be a tautology, but is there any way of fighting bad bacteria without using antibiotics? Is there a second way?
Yeah, there is, and there are two ways. One is certainly vaccines, which can be a powerful tool. Again, vaccines is not easy to develop. They're also quite expensive, and they cannot be developed easily for all infections. There is another one, which is sort of an even older strategy than antibiotics, and that's bacteriophages. This is the time, unfortunately, when everybody's reading about viruses. Well, not all viruses are bad either. Some viruses actually are used as a therapeutic tool. Just as they would infect a human cell, they can also infect a bacterial cell, commandeer its machinery, and basically kill it. Those bacteria are called bacteriophages, discovered about 100 years ago, actually a little more than 100 years ago, first by Englishman Mr. Twort, and then Dr. Twort, and then sort of by another French-Canadian professor, Felix de Hegel. They were used initially as a very potent tool to fight infection. They sort of lost momentum because antibiotics were easy to produce. They could be produced in vast quantities, and there was also skepticism about them because the country that was really taking the lead in producing them was on the other side of the Iron Curtain. That was the Soviet Union. In late 1980s, certainly through the 90s and early 2000s, they have come back as a potent tool. And there have been some studies showing that they can be very, very useful. The challenge with that is that we do not have enough clinical trials under our belt yet to really suggest their widespread use. There are lots of important questions that need to be asked, but I think there is certainly hope and certainly promise there. My own sense, Jesse, is that we will not be in a situation where they'll completely replace antibiotics, but they can certainly complement, which is exactly what we need right now, is to have a more diverse set of approaches, antibiotics and bacteriophages and potentially, in some cases, vaccines as well, as we have seen in the case of typhoid, which might sort of allow us to really save ourselves from this very, very problematic situation that we're in.
I promised listeners we would finish with some optimism. So what is there to be optimistic about?
Well, so I think there are several things. One, I think there are countries that have turned the course if you look at the data of people who suffer from microbial resistant infections, Scandinavia is an excellent example. Netherlands is also another example. New Zealand has done well. So these are countries that have shown that you could do it with good policies and sort of good practice. So that's the first avenue. The second one, I think, is an appreciation that this is no longer a science problem alone. If we assume the scientists alone are going to get us out of this, I think we will be disappointed. By bringing together people from public health and banking and finance and economics and law and certainly national security, there are examples where people are taking some real solutions which can make a difference. What is going to tip the balance, and I argue about that in the book, is basically a set of three things. First of all, we have to recognize that this is a problem in which everybody has to take a part. You cannot have three countries do it and rest 190-something not do it. The second thing is you have to ensure greater efforts towards world peace. And that sounds like a cliche statement, but actually places where conflict is rife are places where antimicrobial resistance is a continuous problem. So we really have to do this, not just because it's the ethically right thing to do, it's the right thing to do from a humanitarian perspective, but also for public health of that region and beyond. And third thing is that we have to invest in sort of this broad portfolio of basic science and applied science and economics and legal contracts across countries. If we do that, I think there is enough momentum in all of these individual sectors that we can really turn things around. Because I think that it's a story of human behavior. It's not a story of sort of bacteria alone. It's a story of human behavior. And if you sort of put that in perspective and bring it in the context of how we can change our collective behavior so that it helps everybody, I remain optimistic. Cautiously optimistic indeed, but I remain optimistic that it can be done. But if we don't do it, then I think the writing is on the wall.
Well, there's more in the book. It's called Biography of Resistance, the epic battle between people and pathogens. And I've been speaking with Mohammed Zaman, Professor of Biomedical Engineering and International Health at Boston University. Thanks for your time and your expertise and the knowledge that you're putting into the world, Mohammed. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me and good luck. Thank you.